Hello and welcome to show 27 of the MisesUK.org podcast with me, Andy Duncan, here in the splendid Henley-on-Thames. Tonight I'm once again speaking with my very good friend and fellow Vice Chairman of Mises UK, and that's England's Mr. Libertarian himself, Dr. Sean Gabb. We'll be talking about his soon-to-be-published book coming out in July entitled Radical Coup, A Case for Reaction. This contains many individual and some quite lengthy essays on mass immigration, controlled borders, multiculturalism, secession, but best of all, and what we'll start with, a general plan for taking back European culture away from the tax-eating state elites. Welcome back to the show then, Dr. Sean Gabb.
Well, after that intro, Andy, what more can I say? I mean, we can just roll wrap the thing up and we can go back to bed.
Yeah, and then I can get my glass of wine in.
Yeah.
So, how are things down there in Kent? I know you've got a nice cup of coffee down there, but how's Deal?
Deal is much the same as it's always been, which I suppose is one reason why I still live here.
Fantastic. And how are the pigeons?
Well, they haven't been physically removed yet, but I believe that is in hand.
Brilliant. Well, let's get Mr. Hopper to come and sort that out for you. Okay, let's get to business then. So first of all, the book itself opens with a 90-page essay on the main plan, and that's probably best described by Professor Hopper in his foreword for your book. So let me quote that for you. Most importantly for libertarians, and as I should confess, much in line with what I've tried to accomplish for quite some time in my own writings, in reaction to the diagnosed disease, Gabb proposes a detailed, equally radical cure that envisions a programmatic alignment of traditional conservatism and libertarianism. And that's with the common goal of restoring a bourgeois society as the highest achievement of Western civilization. So just to get going, and going from that forward, do you agree with Professor Hopper that a bourgeois society is the highest achievement of a commonly shared Western civilization?
Well, I'm afraid, Andy, you're asking me to explain whether air is nice. It's a question so obvious that it's almost unanswerable. But yes, it stands absolutely to reason that the bourgeois civilization in which we live, or in which we have until recently lived, is easily the highest achievement of the human mind. When you compare even the rather degraded version in which we live with anything that went before it or anything that is a rival to it elsewhere in the world, you can see its manifest superiority.
And what do you think are the features then of a bourgeois society that are so good?
Rationalism, a regard for fairness, a dislike of arbitrary power of any kind, and a general focus on the here and now. That is not in any sense to denigrate religion, but in a bourgeois civilization, you have shiny electronic toys in growing abundance, and the freedom to use them to make your life better and to improve the lives of those around you. That is something that no other civilization has been able to boast, and ours boasts it in, as I said, abundance.
That's a nice assessment. So we libertarians, we do like to fight like cats in a bag, unfortunately, and we do have lots of disagreements with traditional conservatives, such as they might be in favour of protectionism and we might not be. So can a plan like yours to join those two groups together, the libertarians and the traditional conservatives, can it work? Can you glue together these two different groups, or will they just get unstuck after just a very short time?
The thing about prospective alliances, indeed the thing about alliances that may have existed for some time, is that being alliances, they are unstable. When you have two allies, each has somewhat different ends. If they didn't, they wouldn't be allies. They would simply be fellow workers in the same cause. And so, yes, there's no reason why this alliance should last a very long time. What has brought us together, I think, is the common realization that we are both slated for extinction by the by what may be called the enemy class. And what I think we as libertarians have to offer is a plan for destroying that enemy class. Many years ago, when I was very young, I suppose, I used to read these libertarian fantasies about what a libertarian government should do in its first 90 days. And it was all very ideological, and it was the kind of thing that very few people would ever be persuaded to vote for. What I'm suggesting is a selective but wide-scale shutting down of the state apparatus. The justification for that in libertarian terms is obvious. Less state is better state. But what I have been trying to persuade conservatives to accept is that they and we together will never take over the machinery of state, at least not the machinery of the extended state in which we live. And so shutting down organizations like English Heritage, let's say, or what's called Heritage in England, or whatever it's now being changed to, shutting down vast swathes of local government is a good thing, not simply because it frees the taxpayers or it frees the citizens from a vast and oppressive burden of government, but because it unfunds the kind of people who are the enemies of bourgeois civilization. It is not an end in itself. It is a tactic in a revolutionary transformation of society to something more desirable in conservative and libertarian terms.
Now, you described there the enemy class. Now, we can call them lots of different names, the cultural Marxists, the new elite, or I just prefer to call them Guardian readers. Now, they have taken over in the last sort of 50, 60, 70 years, ever since the Second World War in the 1940s. And you did identify in the book, and I know that this is a brilliant identification, that although they're wide and diverse and they get paid a lot of money and they have a huge amount of resources, they do all suck from one teat. They do have this fatal Achilles heel for sustenance. Mm. And this is where you think we might be able to chop them down, or as you say in the book, cut off the tap to the shower head. Yeah. Can you just, for our listeners, just lay out very briefly your kind of frontal attack plan for actually doing this?
The idea is to... Sorry, the reason why these people are so dangerous is because they have deeply hostile intentions to the established civilization in our part of the world, and they have the means to carry to go through with those intentions. There's no point arguing with them. For some years, with my dear but unfortunately late friend Chris Tame, for many years, we worked together in a smokers' rights organization called Forest, and we brought out well-reasoned pamphlets and books arguing against the war on smoking. And of course, these had no effect. You may say, well, they had no effect because they weren't very good, or they were bad arguments, or they were wrong arguments. But I think they were pretty good arguments. The reason they had no effect was because we were not arguing in a debating society with people who would listen to your arguments and then say, oh, fancy that, I never thought of that. Oh, well, let's call the whole thing off. No, we were arguing with a set of interest groups whose status and income was wrapped up in believing a number of false propositions. And the way to deal with these people is not to shout louder. It's not to turn up the speed of the printing press. It is to shut them down, to put them on the dole, or to get all these people who are on 100,000 a year scrabbling around looking for work in call centres. That is how you destroy the enemy class. You don't argue with it. You don't say, don't do this, because, well, they've got to do this. It is their nature. If they don't do it, they don't justify their rather nice incomes or indeed their pensions. And so you shut them down. You shut down their organizations, you sack the people, you may cancel their pensions, you burn the archives, and you make sure that if by any misfortune you lose power, it will take a very, very long time to set up these organizations again.
That actually brings me to the biggest puzzle in the book for me, though. I felt a disconnect and I kind of got lost halfway through that long essay. So I was wondering if you could explain this to me, because you say two things and I couldn't quite find the join between them. So you say, well, we need to do this frontal attack plan like sort of Henry VIII taking out the Catholic Church from England. We need to get into power with 300 and whatever it is, 27 MPs, and then use the English Constitution to just rip away all these people, just start deleting government departments and so on, and the BBC and so on. But that leads to the puzzle, because you say in the book, I think you say in the book, that there's no point as forming a new political party, something like a super UKIP or a new UKIP, because that's just a waste of time. So that then to me logically means we're left with the Conservatives. But then almost immediately after that, you say, and I'm just sort of paraphrasing, you tell us the Conservatives are basically useless. And you were right about David Cameron's government being useless. You wrote most of this essay in 2007. You predicted David Cameron would be useless, and you were completely correct in that assessment. So if the Conservatives are useless and we shouldn't form a new political party, how do we get these 350 MPs to execute your plan?
You're right, there is a disconnect. And I'll be honest, I think I've diagnosed pretty well what's wrong and why it's wrong. And I've suggested a means of not putting it exactly right, but of making things a great deal better. The question of how to get into power to do these radical things is something on which I must confess I am rather hazy. The only justification I can give for that haziness is that all of the attempted ways into power that I've seen, starting new political parties, taking over existing political parties, etc., have failed. One after the other, they've failed, and they've failed for very obvious reasons. And so what I'm looking for, or what I'm doing, I suppose, is the intellectual equivalent of whistling up a wind. I'm hoping for a lucky set of circumstances. And these things do turn up from time to time. Although I, in common with many other people, perhaps you as well, am disappointed with Donald Trump. He looked extraordinarily promising during the American presidential election. And who would have predicted that somebody would be able to run for president with the policies that he announced and win the election? It was a lucky stroke. And I suppose what I'm doing is I'm hoping and I'm waiting for a similar stroke of luck in this country.
I suppose as well with you're laying out the plan for what to do should we get into a position to do it. And then maybe if some combination of Brexit working, Scotland devolving, Wales going, England just being left as a single country, there might be some lucky strokes like that. I mean, that's just my belief for a long time. Secession is just the best way forward for everything. But if we talk about getting onto another one of your essays then in the book, getting onto Margaret Thatcher, the reason why the Conservative Party is so useless at the moment, back in the 1970s when she came to power, and to this day, a lot of American libertarians still love Margaret Thatcher very much, but you don't. You don't like her at all, because even though she used to hand out Hayek's Constitution of Liberty and say she believed in that, you see her as Tony Blair or New Labour's midwife. So can you tell us, maybe in the words of George Best, the famous words of George Best, when do you think it all started going wrong for Margaret Thatcher?
Oh, that's a question that would require me to look inside her mind. I think it probably went rotten the day after she was elected. It was then that she should have had a decent plan for dealing with the problems we faced. Indeed, before she'd come up with a decent plan, she should have had a proper diagnosis of what was actually wrong with the country. And her diagnosis, which was shared by many other people, was simply that the trade unions were out of control. I'm not defending the trade unions in the 1970s. I am well old enough to remember what went on at the time. But as we go into the 1980s, she defined the enemy as a group of aging men who might have fought on the wicked side in the Spanish Civil War and might have wanted to nationalize all the supermarkets. The tide of history was ebbing for these people. They were no serious danger. The real danger was the suit-wearing, mineral-water-quaffing university graduates who didn't want to nationalize the means of production. They called themselves postmodernists or post-Fordists, and they spoke about an accommodation with markets. She assumed that they were broadly on her side, and she made life very easy for them. But of course they weren't on our side at all. These were the proto-Blairites. And instead of attacking them, instead of stripping out all the, instead of gutting all the institutions that they then colonized, she was obsessed with doing over Arthur Scargill and indeed to virtually the entire manufacturing working class of this country. And then there were, of course, all her legal and constitutional changes, which set every precedent that the Blair government was then able to use. Everything the Blair government did had obvious precedents in the long period of Thatcher or Thatcher Major Thatcherite government after 1979. She was the midwife of the new Labour police state. Tony Blair didn't start a revolution when he got in. He simply consummated a revolution that Margaret Thatcher had worked. And for that reason, I don't admire the woman. Rather like Donald Trump, she was propelled into office in 1979 by a tidal wave of revulsion against what was being done to England. And she then just continued doing it.
Now, another lady that you're not particularly keen on in the book is Her Madge, God bless her, Queen Elizabeth II. Now, as someone who likes watching The Crown and is looking forward to the third series, I'd struggle with any kind of republic and I'd much prefer a monarchy on the way to Hopper World. Do you actually want to get rid of the monarchy?
No, I'm a conservative, among other things, and it's impossible not to bear in mind that her family, in one branch or another, has been running this country ever since the 7th century. And to do some French style, well, to do another Cromwell even, is very hard to imagine. But she has been, if you'll pardon the expression, she's been a piss-poor queen during the past 60-odd years.
Ooh.
60 years a rubber stamp, that's the title of one of the essays, and that's what it is. The only thing that she's ever quibbled about signing, so far as I can tell, is personal checks. Everything else she's nodded through. The European Communities Act, 1972. She could, she should, have demanded a referendum on that. But no, she just signed it. And so it goes on. The deal, you know, rather than talk about social contracts, a very loaded term, the deal during the past 400 years is 300 years, let's say, the deal during the past 300 years is that she sits back, she lets the ministers accountable to Parliament, a Parliament that in turn is accountable to us, run the country. And that's it. We have a constitutional monarchy. But one of the implied terms of the deal is that when the ministers turn rotten, and when the parliament turns rotten, and when they cease in any meaningful sense to be accountable to us, it's her duty to step in and rebalance the constitution. She and her ancestors have not been there simply to smile and wave. They're there as a paperweight for our way of life, and she has failed to keep that part of the deal. Now, what to do about it? I don't know. I don't fancy guillotining the old dear. And, you know, I share your dislike of a republic. When you look at the politicians who get elected to Parliament, I can shudder to think of the kind who might get elected as president. Perhaps a change in the line of succession, bearing in mind that when Elizabeth the Useless croaks, we'll get Charles the Mad and then William the Useless.
Well, I'm hoping myself, I don't know how it would happen, but for King Harry the Ninth to get onto the throne, I think that would keep me happy. Now, let's get back to your plan then. You do have some great things in there, such as completely obliterating the BBC on day one of the frontal attack, which is a noble goal in and of itself. But there's some things in your plan which could upset some libertarians, and one of those is keeping the welfare state in place. Now, don't you think that's going to, again, debalance your kind of alliance if you're keeping the welfare state and lots of libertarians don't want the welfare state?
Well, yes, I can understand that many libertarians are following the rather wooden interpretation of the non-aggression principle would say that the welfare state is evil. And I fully accept that the welfare state as it presently exists is not a very inspiring thing. The welfare paid out, indeed, the healthcare given by the National Health Service, these things are peripheral to the real purpose of these institutions, which is to provide jobs and status for members of the enemy class. At the same time, we have to accept that every European civilization that has ever existed has had some degree of support for the poor. It has subsidized some degree of education for the poor and has provided some degree of healthcare to the poor. And to abandon that at one stroke without letting anything else evolve to stand in its place would be against the entire drift of the past 3,000 years of European or European-style civilizations. The other thing is that if we ever get into power, we shall at least need the consent of the great majority of people when we start shutting down the BBC and unfunding all of these worthless middle-class leftists. And I'm afraid taking their welfare away, their welfare in the widest sense, I'm defining it not just as unemployment benefits, but as old age pensions, free treatment under the NHS, free education, etc. Taking that away is not going to make you very popular. And the other thing to bear in mind is that the enemies of bourgeois civilization are not the people being handed out a pittance through the welfare system every few weeks, but the people who are handing the money out. They are the enemy. They're the ones who must be destroyed. Welfare dependency is undesirable and needs to be sorted out in the long term, but the across-the-board immediate abolition of welfare is a non-starter. And any libertarian who is unable to see that, I suggest, is uninterested in movement towards a better state of affairs.
Now, I'm completely in line with your plan myself, but just I was thinking of some of these people who do fight like cats in a bag. One of the major parts of that welfare state is the NHS, and I don't know about you, but one of the most deeply depressing moments in my life was watching the opening ceremony of the 2012 Olympic Games in London. And we had evil capitalists in evil top hats, and then we had that orgasmic love festival for the NHS, which I found quite disturbing, really. So maybe we do have to put up with that for maybe 20, 30, maybe even 40 years. But before we get to your frontal attack then, your frontal attack to destroy all these middle-class leftists, the Guardian readers, and get them doing proper jobs, what can we do to re-establish a culture of English freedom before we get to that point where we can carry out this parliamentary attack?
I've spent the past 40-odd years watching these movements for radical change formed. And I've watched them disintegrate, the referendum party, UKIP. Oh, they go on and on and on. I don't know how many libertarian parties we've had. The problem is that all of these organizations are wide open to capture by nutters and bores who like five-hour committee meetings and, of course, who like purging each other. And you've then got the 80-20 rule where most political activists are concerned. 80% of any funding goes on whores and cocaine. Oh, the other 20% goes on getting the actual job done. Now, rather than advocating the creation of yet another political movement, what I would suggest is that in our private lives, we establish a steady preference for dealing with our own. That is, if someone knocks on the door saying, "Do you want your windows cleaned?" you make a number of inquiries about his opinion about the nature and scope of government and the degree of individual freedom that he supports, i.e. you should do business with libertarian or conservative window cleaners. And the same with builders, the same with dentists, the same with lawyers, the same with almost anyone to whom you give money. Now, of course, this is not a rigid preference. If you're unfortunate enough to have a brain tumor and the best person for cutting it out is a Guardian reader, well, you just have to grit your teeth and lie back. But where window cleaners, builders, cleaners of all kinds, where the kind of people that we give money to are concerned, we should give a steady preference to our own. We should build communities of shared value or communities of shared Englishness. Now, that will not bring about a revolution overnight, but what it will do, it will produce networks that are very difficult to break. Now, let me give you an example of this. Let me give you two examples. Anjum Chowdhury, the Islamic troublemaker, he was done over by the state a few years ago, shut away in prison, quite unjustly, said so at the time. He was shut away for expressing his opinion about the Syrian civil war, which, as far as I'm concerned, is fair comment. I may or may not agree with it, but it's his opinion. Now, when he comes out of prison, he will not have trouble finding somewhere to live. He will not have trouble getting an income that lets him pay his gas bills. The reason for that is that he is a member of a tight community. People who will gather around him and won't care that he has a less than spotless disclosure and barring service certificate. And that is the kind of network or the kinds of network that I would like us begin to form. Because at the moment, it doesn't matter what we believe, we can blow off in public about the non-aggression principle or damn the Guardian readers or whatever, but we are ultimately atomized individuals. If the government wants to pounce on us and turn our lives upside down, it can do so, and there are not many people who make a fuss about it. And worse than that, there are not many people who will stick with us. It makes us realize that if you make a stand, there may be no one behind you to back you up. Now, after a generation of giving a steady preference to our own, you will have communities in the real sense, rather like the Muslims in this country have. And that will make us inevitably stronger. It means, among other things, that vote-seeking politicians will have to pay some attention to our wishes.
It sounds very much to me like something that happened in Austria in the early 19th century, I think called the Biedermeier period, where the middle classes kind of withdrew to their drawing rooms, enjoyed their Mozart and their Goethe and so on, and just kind of looked after themselves. Anyway, let's get on. Now, in the final part of the book, you do talk about Islam, immigration and multiculturalism. And I'm going to let our listeners buy the book to find out about that, because I'd like to talk about the speech you gave at the Mises UK conference here in January this year, which was a splendid event. And there you make this plea for a libertarian Toryism as a kind of a way forward. Just to finish off, it does sound a bit like paleo-libertarianism, which did die out in about 2010. So, can you tell us maybe the difference between paleo-libertarianism, which kind of died out, and your idea for a libertarian Toryism?
They are different names for the same general tendency. As I understand it, an American paleo-libertarian is somebody who believes in a strict interpretation of the 1787 Constitution, which means an enormous free space vacated by the authorities. The federal state stops interfering in the states, and the states stop interfering with the districts, and the districts stop interfering with individuals, and people live their lives in much the way expected by the founding fathers of the American Republic. A libertarian Tory doesn't have a 1787 constitution to point to, but what we do have is a set of traditional rules and conventions about the nature and the scope of government, and a belief in freedom and fairness, which are things of permanent value and which, well, I would once have said are being eroded, but I will now say have been largely stripped away, and which we should do our utmost to restore. And if you are an English conservative, you have no honest choice but to believe in a very high degree of individual liberty. If at the same time you are an English libertarian, you again have no honest choice but to look to the example of the English past. Most classical liberal and indeed libertarian theory is little more than a meditation on English constitutional history. And so there, if you think in terms of a Venn diagram, libertarianism and conservatism are circles which very largely overlap. They do not completely overlap, but they do very largely overlap. I've never felt any reservation in saying I am a libertarian and I am a conservative. My late friend Chris Tame did agree with that formulation. And I can't see any argument against that proposition.
I think I'm pretty much the same. So I've got no problem with it at all. I just worry that paleo-libertarianism sort of died out. So how can we stop it dying out again in the future? Anyway, we might come back to that another day. I think we've covered most of the main parts of this great new book, which for anyone listening, by the way, I've read the whole thing. It's wonderfully written. It's 250 pages or so, but it only took me about 5 hours to read the whole thing because it's so well written. Before we wrap up, Sean, is there anything else you'd like to add, or is there anything we need to know about your very good friend, Mr. Richard Blake?
Well, Mr. Blake has continued churning out historical fiction over the past few years. A new omnibus edition of four of his novels is coming out in the next few months. Its title has not been entirely settled yet, but The Boy from Aquileia is one of the possible titles.
Oh, I like it.
Otherwise, the last novel that Mr. Blake wrote is The Devil's Treasure, which has sold rather well and received some rather nice reviews. And you can pick it up at Amazon or at any other online bookseller.
Well, I just hope it gets picked up by Hollywood when they need to replace Game of Thrones, and then that'll be great for you. And when's Radical Coup coming out?
Well, it is actually available at the moment. I'm just not publicising it. It's been available since about 6 o'clock this morning. The thing about publishing books is that it's a good idea to smuggle them out and then to launch them sometime later. It means that, well, there are no embarrassments if the thing is out already.
Excellent. Anyway, thank you very much for your time tonight, Dr. Sean Gabb.
And thank you, Andy.
We hope you enjoyed listening to tonight's interview with the good doctor. If you did, we'd love it if you spread links to it all over your favourite social media sites. Sean's book, Radical Coup, A Case for Reaction, as he said, is out now. And if you want to find out more about it, just go to www.seangabb.co.uk. In the meantime, it does take us quite a bit of cash to keep the lights on here at Mises UK. So our gallant leader, Mr. Keir Martland, would like me to ask you if you could please, pretty please, with a sweet cherry on top, visit our donate page at misesuk.org and help spread the love by sending us some of that terrible fiat paper money. We do hereby pledge that when we do come to power as a direct result of your generosity, that will institute a complete freedom in money production. This will be in line with the thoughts of Mises, Rothbard, Hayek, and Professor Guido Hulsman, who I'm hoping to speak to early in July. So until next time, enjoy the World Cup and the sunshine, and do remember, please look after your property and freedom responsibly.